And now for another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Episode.
Why is the fat guy named Porkins?
So, let's see, we took a week off for Thanksgiving. Did you have a Thanksgiving?
I gave thanks. I went to my friend Magda's, which is a kind of a tradition, and we ate ourselves stupid. And then watched, what did we watch? We always watch something stupid. We watched The Room, the Tommy Wiseau movie.
The Room. Oh, that's the... yeah.
Lisa, you're tearing me apart!
Right. Yeah. Oh, my. Yeah, that's not the brightest of films, I have to say. It's got its moments, though.
Oh, it's hilarious. I mean, because it's so bad, and he's so serious, so earnest.
Yeah, it was not. Oof, yeah.
What about you? You
I went, had a very small, very intimate Thanksgiving. It was quite lovely. Just a couple of friends and such. So it was just, you know, a very small group. Usually I do a lot of the cooking, although this year I didn't do a lot of the cooking. Instead, I baked. I wound up baking a rather lovely apple pie.
Yummy.
I'm not much of a baker. Because that's chemistry, and I was a physics minor, and that's a totally different science. But it turned out fairly well. The secret was actually having a vodka crust. A vodka crust, indeed. It's an America's Test Kitchen recipe, and what you do is it's the normal ingredients. It's a butter and shortening crust with flour. Bit of sugar, a bit of salt, and then water. But instead of around a half a cup of water, what you're doing is you're cutting half of the water with vodka. So quarter cup of water, quarter cup of vodka, and the vodka, because it will evaporate, winds up leaving the crust very flaky and very nice and very light.
Fair enough.
So check that out. I'll put the recipe in the show notes because it was pretty easy to follow, it turned out really well. So the only problem I had was that my oven is not particularly accurate, and so the outer crust got a little bit too brown. It wasn't catastrophic, but had I thought beforehand, I would have put aluminium foil around the edges.
You mean aluminum?
Yes. You know, when I don't think about it, I put the extra I in there. Well, it's not an extra I. If you take a look at all the other elements in that column.
It's okay. I ordered tomato soup today at lunch, and the lady looked at me funny. I'm like, tomato.
Oh. Oh, my. Let's see. This morning, I also... I've been playing catch with my orthopedist.
Oh yes, how's that going?
Yeah, well, he said that I'm pretty much done. He said, you know, don't come back unless you have to. So that's a really good sign. I've been going to the gym fairly regularly again, which is nice psychologically, if anything else. And so yeah, he took a look at it. He gave me a little bit of a strength test. He asked me to, you know, push and pull on his hand, and. Yeah, no pain, no nothing. And he said, you know, it's going to be fairly weak for a while, but, you know, just start off slowly and work it.
Just to recap for the folks that don't know, which meat did you pull off of which bone again?
Oh, right, yes. So, let's see, at the end of July, just before the Oregon Brewers Festival, as a matter of fact, a few days
before I left
for the Oregon Brewers Festival,
That will come up again, folks.
Yes, it will. I wound up severing my left biceps tendon while at the gym doing preacher curls. It wasn't particularly a heavy weight or anything. It was at the end of my routine. There's no reason I should have severed it. It just happened. It sounded as if it were a tree ripping itself apart from the weight of snow or something. It was audible. And it was incredibly, intensely painful.
Well, it was at the end of your routine, and that's when you jump off the block and you do the split, and then you throw your arms up in the air, right?
Yes, that's exactly when. And the sparklers and the flags and the confetti. Yes.
USA! USA!
And the Russian judge giving me, you know, 3.4.
The story that was a billion years in the making of a boy, a girl, and a universe. One of the most dazzling entertainments of all time. Star Wars next.
With regard to Star Wars, the film itself, obviously, the original trilogy and even the extended prequel trilogy, it was fairly groundbreaking. I mean, obviously, the original film, Star Wars, was groundbreaking at the time. I think it really hit upon, you know, just mass popular culture almost instantaneously. You know, the first round, when it was released in the cinema, it got, you know, there were plenty of people going out to see it, and then word got around, and then suddenly, you know, I believe it's the first coining of the term blockbuster. I could be wrong about that, but it was certainly very evident when you saw these newsreels with people, you know, standing outside, you know, blocks and blocks and blocks trying to get into the cinema.
During the daytime, no less.
Yeah.
I've seen so many pictures of people, out, you know, standing outside during the day to go see it. And I know people, they were like, at the time, I mean, because there's no other media, people would go and then they'd go again and then they'd go again because, you know, you can't go home and watch the trailer on YouTube because there is no YouTube.
Right,
so
and they
if
had,
you wanted
and,
to really get, experience a thing, you could just, you know, you just went to the movies again and again.
And the cinema usually was either a single screen or it was a twin. You know, you didn't have 30 screens
right.
at a cinema. So you didn't have it showing in multiple screens at a single location. I remember the first time I saw it. It was during its original run. I was very young at the time. Let's see. And I remember being entirely blown away and captivated by it. I mean, it really changed everything for me.
Yeah, same here. I was also pretty young, but I remember my cousin and I. I can't remember if any adults. It's funny that everything surrounding seeing Star Wars is eclipsed by the seeing of Star Wars. All I remember was my cousin and I went. I don't remember if adults stayed with us or not. I have no recollection because from the moment it started, I was just, you know, out of my head, you know, obsessed and in love with this thing. So much so that my cousin and I, we went and, you know, built our little R2-D2 out of, you know, cars and little electric cars and stuff. It was amazing.
Nice.
It was really a seminal moment in any geek's life was the first time you see that.
Yeah, I mean, it made me think of science. It made me think of what could be. Rather than you know the day to day what is, it allowed me to think about things that I'd never considered before, and not only from a storytelling point of view, because to be perfectly frank, I mean the story is it is a fairly timeless story that's been told over and over again in, you know, countless other films,
right.
Other books, etc. I mean these are archetypical characters and an archetypical story. You know, it's fairly well known.
It's the hero's journey, and it, you know.
Right, you know, it's fairly well known that the original film, Star Wars, which eventually became Episode 4, A New Hope, was ripped off from, you know, a lot of Kurosawa films and you know, childhood films here and there, and, you know, the space dogfight scenes were all taken from, you know, World War II. Or even some of the World War I films that were out,
right.
You know, the flying ace type of stuff,
right? Which is not a rip on Lucas because those Kurosawa movies also come from, you know, there are stories that were told in the Japanese culture that he drew from to make those films, you know. So these are when you said archetypes, you mean like base archetypes that have been around for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
Oh yeah, since man was living in caves, terrified of the sun. I mean, these stories really are timeless, and I think that's why they hit.
Actually, I think Lucas changed those paintings so that they were terrified of
dragons. CGI critters. Yeah, that's entirely possible. Yeah, that's entirely possible. It was just, I mean, it blew my mind. I mean, the whole idea of, oh, here they are in space, and oh, there's this, you know, huge, dark figure, you know, very menacing, very imposing, and it's very clear that he's, you know, killing a lot of people, and then you have this young kid who's kind of whiny, but he's forced to act and you know, be a part of something, and he realizes that suddenly he's a part of something much bigger than himself, and you know that's a universal theme which, you know, everyone can kind of relate to on a, you know, on a very base level.
Yeah, and then the visuals for you and I were something we had never seen before. Now, I do recognize that, you know, the 2001 A Space Odyssey did the, you know, the space scene better than anyone had ever seen it done, you know, so much so that it was quite more than believably real. It, you know, it seemed completely real, but that wasn't something that you or I, as, you know, as little kids would have been exposed to.
And it was almost too real. You know,
it was an adult movie. It wasn't a kids movie.
Right, exactly. It was a movie targeted at adults. It used basic scientific principles, meaning that there's no air in space, so it's not going to make a sound. You know, and everything looked very natural, and it was all, but still, it was also very familiar. Just barely, you know, it was all in our solar system. This is something from, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It was entirely foreign and yet familiar on familiar on that base level, because it is that archetypical story. It's both fascinating and familiar.
Which, yeah, you immediately grok that because it has that down in the dirt basis in just life. But then the mind-blowing visuals, I mean, the moment you see that Star Destroyer that never ends in the beginning, and you're just freaking mesmerized, because this is like nothing you've ever seen in your life. Everything you've seen so far has been hokey or, you know, cheap-looking. I mean, literally, unless you had seen 2001 somehow. And then the next thing you know, here are these real robots on the screen. And a lot of people thought they were real because they just seemed so amazing, you know?
Yeah, they were living characters. They weren't puppets. Exactly. I mean, well, actually, they R2-D2 was R2-D2
was a puppet. Kind of a puppet.
but they didn't look like sock puppets. They weren't marionettes.
They immediately had personalities.
Exactly. And so therefore you could relate to them. And yes, you know, when you saw it in 1977, 1978, you were a little kid and you allowed yourself that suspension of disbelief and you just accepted them. You accepted them as, full on characters. Looking at the film now, special editions and all the Lucas edits aside, there's still a huge nostalgia bomb of watching the film. Otherwise, you know, obviously I don't think that it would have been the hit that it is. It has stuck in our collective consciousness.
Well, like you mentioned at the very beginning, it was kind of a convergence. All the right things came together at the right times. They created the computer-controlled motion control camera to do this over at Colonel Dykstra. We were talking earlier, Dykstra building that. That was brand new, never been done. So they were doing these amazing effects on screen that no one had ever really done the same way, because, you know, Kubrick's movie, a lot of that had to be done using optical techniques. Now, they went the long route to make them look really great, but, you know, and a lot of stuff done in camera. But, you know, what Lucas was doing, you know, with all the motion and, you know, and so forth, that just was never been done before. And all that stuff converged right at the right time to, you know, it was bleeding edge, but it all worked. And this amazing movie came out of it.
Right. And now, you know, we're a little bit jaded. And so therefore, you know, we're used to seeing very high quality CGI effects, or computer-generated effects, versus a much more practical-based approach, meaning using real models or real objects. And I think that's one of the major differences between, or at least the ones that I've noticed, even though I'm much older and the films technically aren't targeted toward me or what have you, I've noticed that the thing I have the most problem with is that Lucas decided in the prequel trilogy that computer graphics are so good that we no longer need to have actual sets. And the actors, while, you know, these are very talented actors and actresses, you know, they've been in other films and they've done, you know, spectacular jobs, but being in a gigantic green screen room with nothing real around it, you just can't get around that. You know, as much as you are supposed to being a professional actor, there's still a lot missing if you can't physically grab a hold of something.
Right, and I'll give you an example of something that. Jabba's barge, we're not talking about the first movie, of course, but Jabba's flying barge. Recently someone came across some pictures that someone had taken out in the desert that they just kind of stumbled on the production while it was out there. And there are all these pictures of the giant barge set, and it's immense. I mean, there were parking tractor trailers underneath it, you know, the structure that it sits on. That's, you know, it was enormous. But can you imagine how much that added to the actors, you know, to be able to work in that space? You know, you are constrained by, oh, you're going to fall off if you go too far or things like that, versus on the stage, oh, you're just going to hit this mat if you go too far. Woo. So,
yeah, it's a totally different feel. You know, you can, as an actor, you can, you get a sense of space and a sense of place when you are on a real stage, or, you know, on a real soundstage or on location with a real set, right. Where, you know, again, you've seen the non-matted versions of the prequel trilogy, and you see they're in a giant green room, and the vehicle that they're on is not a vehicle, but a giant green brick, you know.
Okay.
And all that is painted in after the fact.
Yeah.
Now, and it's, you know.
To play devil's advocate, I'm not saying that I'm like some sort of grumpy purist and I think it should all go back to being that way. I'm not saying that either. And I don't think you are either. But there definitely is a point where, you know, yes, sure, you know, the CGI can do all that, the dog fights and stuff that you had to work so laboriously to do with motion control cameras. Sure, it can do that so much better and with less tedium and whatnot. And, you know, and the repeatability is perfect instead of almost perfect. But I do think that, like you say, that there's a certain aesthetic that's lost for actors, and I don't think you should just give that up all the time. And I think Lucas was, like you say, he was willing to just give it up all the time. I mean, an opposite of that is like Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow. I like the movie. It's not a great movie, but I'm a big fan of, you know, the director and the whole process of that, and that whole period. But that really had to be done green screen. There wasn't a whole lot of way around it. But a lot of what Lucas did, he could have done on some more, if not completely, at least partially practical sets.
Well, it's also not like he didn't have a budget. I mean, Scott Captain, if I recall correctly, had a budget of a ham sandwich.
May 1977. A legion of fans are already waiting when Star Wars opens at Hollywood's legendary Chinese theater. Similar record-breaking crowds gather at the openings in Australia and England. Eager moviegoers rewrite the record books around the world as George Lucas's science fiction adventure becomes an unprecedented international phenomenon.
The thing that always bothered me about Star Wars, all the bad guys are British. All the heroes are American. What exactly is going on there?
It's the Nazi aesthetic, you know, where in all the movies, all the Nazis talked with a British accent.
I'm sensing conspiracy. Well, also, I mean, the reality of the situation is that, you know, they were trying to do this fairly inexpensively. They were filming at Pinewood at the time, and so therefore they got people who were local, you know, so that is what happened. Obviously people like Peter Cushing are a little bit more famous than random local bloke who happens to be on a movie set, but
Sir Alec Guinness,
etc.
Sorry,
I would say also Sir Alec Guinness or
right.
You know, although then I don't think he was actually knighted. But yeah, it was just a bizarre thing that all the heroes are American. Well, C-3PO, one exception.
Well, my guess being that, you know, that it, like you say, it was really a factor of, well, this is who we have and this is where we're filming, so therefore you guys are all British, except for you, random guy who's not British.
You're going to be the hero of the film.
Yeah. Well, wasn't there one of the I don't know what you call him, the
random stormtrooper? If I recall correctly, the stormtrooper voice, you know, that you heard sort of over the stormtrooper calm voice,
right?
Was American.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of people that did the voice.
And of course, Darth Vader.
And I think they were, yeah, that's right. I think both of the stormtrooper voices were either American or at least, both of them were American.
Right. But of course, Darth Vader wound up being a good guy in the very end anyway. So I don't think I'm spoiling anything. I mean, films.
You know, I will give it, since we're going down that path right quick, I have to give Lucas credit for one thing that never occurred to me until all the movies were done. R2-D2 is the hero of this story.
Oh, yeah. And definitely.
It's like, in hindsight, you know, everyone wants to love R2-D2. Oh, he's so cute and yada, yada, yada. But, you know, Luke is a hero. But R2-D2 is the glue that holds the entire thing together.
Yep.
He's the one that brings the plans, you know, from the princess. He's the one that knows all the stuff all along.
He's the one that doesn't get exploded. He's right. He's the one that you know, doesn't get mind wiped. He's the one that you know, houses Luke's lightsaber until it's the right time.
Breakdown of this. Did you see that?
I have seen it. It's been forever.
To it. Oh, it was so good, it just opens your eyes, and you're like, oh my god!
Yes, suddenly the scales come off, and you see for the first time.
Yeah.
Let's see. He brings the plans to he stores the plans for Princess Leia. He brings them to the Rebel base. Let's see. He also. Let's see. He's the one that, has a lightsaber. He's the one that fishes around and figures out where they are in Dagobah.
Right.
Right. So, you know, he's the one that sort of, you know, flops out into the swamp and then, you know, kind of gets his bearings and such. He's kind of the linchpin of the entire thing. And he never gets a medal.
Right.
You know, Chewie in the re-release finally gets a medal, but R2 never gets a medal. It's really bad.
Well, Chewie complained, and you always, you know, you let the Wookiee win.
Somewhere in space, this may all be happening right now. 20th Century Fox and George Lucas, the man who brought you American Graffiti, now bring you an adventure unlike anything on your planet.
It's my Wookiee noise.
Very good.
Yes. The other question I've always had is, like, why is the fat guy named Porkins?
Oh, Porkins. He's my favorite.
I know. And then, of course, he dies in a flaming ball of death. Poor fellow.
Because he's a fat guy. Of course he dies.
So sad. And, of course, Family Guy had that big send-up as well.
Oh, yeah.
In the one of the better episodes of Family Guy. I have a love-hate relationship with Family Guy. I mean, it's the same joke over and over again for a half an hour times X number of episodes times X number of seasons. But the I have to say the Star Wars episodes of Family Guy were really, really well done.
Oh, yeah. If you're out there listening and you haven't watched them, really, it's totally worth getting all three and watch them. They are hilarious.
What them rebels do, anyways?
You know your friend, Alan?
Yeah, I like Alan.
They took his dog!
They took Zeus? Oh, no!
One of the other things I wanted to talk about was the fictional technology in Star Wars itself. You know, we've got this whole used universe concept where we've got these huge trash can-like starships that are clearly capable of light speed, or faster than light speed. We've got lightsabers, we've got holograms, we've got all that sort of stuff. But it looks, you know, junky. You know, it looks like it's been beat up. It looks like everything is, you know, on its last legs and held together with, you know, chewing gum and baling wire.
Right, it's been passed down, or it's been sold, or it's changed hands. The Millennium Falcon being a prime example of that.
Yeah, sure. It's the Millennium. Well, let's see. So Han got the Millennium Falcon in a bet, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
That's sort of interesting. And then that's a Corellian spacecraft.
Sure, if you say so.
Yes, this is where my inner nerd comes out.
This is where I start to lose.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, but also I believe Hannah's Corellian as well, so that makes a little bit of sense. Someone I'm sure will chime in the comments or something like that. No, he's actually this and that and the other thing.
Darkman Scott, if you're listening, we're very, very sorry.
Yeah, I'm. There's a limit to my nerddom. There really is, but it's broad. You know, I've got lots of nerddom in many, many different areas. But
we're nerd polymaths.
There we go. I like that. I like that. You know, the whole concept of the lightsaber. Here it is, this sort of coalesced, intense plasma beam that has an end.
Yeah.
I mean. That's kind of interesting. Still trying to figure that one out.
And they're all old. When we get to A New Hope, these are all very old things that have been passed. You know, Luke's has been passed down from his father, who's been gone for several years. So
right. This
is not a new piece of technology.
And that's the weird thing that I still don't quite understand. If you take a look at A New Hope, and then you take a look at the modern prequel trilogy, the timelines don't seem to make sense. It seems to me that, you know, they
are
talk about...
Are we going to go there?
Well, we don't have to, you know...
If we're
going to
go there, we should go there.
Oh, dear. No. Well, there's always the problem of prequels, right? Because you know what happens at in the end.
Right.
You know, so did it make sense to make the prequels anyway? Well, considering how they turned out, I guess maybe not. You know, that said, you know, the generation that is not our generation, the generation younger than we,
right?
The Clone
Wars
those
generation.
Films. Yeah, they love those films. Mm. Just like we did when we had ours. So, you know what? You know, those films don't target us. You know, I don't particularly like them. I think the acting is generally wooden. I think the storyline is kind of unfortunate. But, you know, the kids love them and
yeah, and more power to them. I mean, it brings them to Star Wars.
Yeah.
Part of Star Wars is it becomes something that's your own eventually. No, I was going to say, it becomes something that, like now, you and I are sitting here talking about this. We're not going over the story, you know. We're more talking about what it does to you, what it makes you think, and how it influenced your life, and yada, yada, yada. So yeah, I mean, it's great bringing a new generation to that thing so that they can step back through this and you know, and have that same feeling and that same excitement. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I mean,
I hated all three movies.
And it brings, it brings new blood into science and technology and storytelling in a way that most other films simply cannot.
Right, because it's steeped in that, you know, that hero's journey motif, you know. And hey, it brought the Clone Wars, which is it's done stupendously on television. It's immensely popular, you know. So
yeah, hey, I'm the Luddite without the DVR, but
it's not really targeted at us. I mean, although we probably might enjoy it, but
I quite enjoy it. I think
it's great.
The plots are really well done. I like the fact that it is very much serialized, as if it were the old Lone Ranger radio dramas.
Right, and they did, instead of just like, well, let's make a Star Wars thing, they said, let's make a thing that people will enjoy. How do we do that? Which is, you know, always the right way to go. So it was clear there was a lot of love that went in. I mean, they had, you know, they started off with Genndy Tartakovsky, so that was, you know, perfect thing to do, number one. Because he's, you know, he just understands making fun comics cartoons that kids like.
Sure.
You know, so that was a perfect move on their part there. So,
and also the artistry that goes into it. I mean, the textures are, you know, it's a purposely stylized universe,
which is, again, is a brilliant idea, because if you plan it that way, and this is the look we're going for, and also, this look doesn't require a whole lot of, you know, rendering. We can do this, you know, on with a lot less power and do it on, you know, for a television show and not have it cost a fortune.
And still make it look really cool. I mean, that's kind of what World of Warcraft did. You know, their rendering engine is ancient. You know, their models are cartoonish. You know, they're not trying to be hyper-realistic, which I think adds, or at least added, to the game quite a bit. I think nowadays, maybe they're looking a little bit too dated, but a lot of their competition try to make the characters look fairly realistic. You know, humans were fairly thin, you know, slight of build. And because they couldn't devote enough polygons to all the characters all the time, because if you've got, you know, 100 people in a zone, or 1,000 people in a zone, or 10,000 people in a zone, you know, no graphics card is going to be able to catch up with that.
Right.
So
all that churning starts and it becomes a thing that people talk about.
Right, exactly. It becomes, you know, one frame, and then people just stop paying for it, and then people stop playing it. And Warcraft was really great. They said, you know what, we'll make this, you know, we'll have a very specific style, and we'll slowly change that style over time to try to just keep it fresh, but it'll always retain that, fun, very often cartoony is used as a derogative term, but I don't mean it derogatively, I mean it sincerely.
Yeah, and I can think of a good example of that is, like you say, that all these other games were trying for this, if not hyper real, at least somewhat real, you know, look, and you know, where it gets hard. And around that same time, what comes along and grabs people's attention is games that use cell shading. You know, yeah. all these cell shader games came out, and people were like, oh, this is awesome. You know, it looks like a cartoon.
Right. Because your brain isn't trying to say, oh, they're trying to be realistic. And right. So, you know, your brain just relaxes. It's, I imagine it's sort of uncanny valley adjacent, where it's, you know, your brain isn't freaking out because these characters are too close to reality, because they're clearly not. But they are realistic enough that you expect them to have certain better realistic capabilities. For example, things like arm waving or anything involving inverse kinematics. You know, if you don't have, if you've got too much dampening on the movements or what have you, even if you're doing motion capture, and then just translating that directly, it doesn't look quite right.
Right. If you're putting a lot of knee on the movement, so like, well, that was a little too swift. So it's being, quantized, you know, that shows up too, you know, even in motion capture.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And it winds up being sort of herky jerky. Whereas if you've got something that isn't trying to look realistic at all, you don't have expectations of how gravity works or how physics works. You can just kind of go with it.
And which is, again, back we were talking about earlier, why some people are kind of starting to relax and allow more practicals back in, I think, because really you don't have to fight against, you know, we need to tweak that. Doesn't look real.
Yeah.
Still doesn't look real. It's like, it looks real because it's in camera.
Yeah. and that's just it. And that is one of the things that has been a little bit elusive in pure CGI. I mean, obviously they're getting better every year and all that.
Sure.
And they're significantly better than the original, you know, 1990s re-release of Star Wars, where we had the Jabba the Hutt.
Oh, that's
that looked
so bad.
It was unfortunate.
Didn't we decide that Stu probably worked on that? We're very, very sorry, but it looks so bad.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But yeah, it's just, you know, the technology wasn't there, and a practical model will have a gravitas, even if that model is very, very small. Because it exists in real space.
Right. All the things that you can't really. I mean, yes, technology is racing towards, you know, fully realized characters, yada, yada, yada. Then that's fine, and we'll do all that. But there are situations, and there are still a lot of situations where the amount of minute details that the human mind picks up and uses to, you know, we are very, very good with faces. Why? Because faces are what we've been doing since, you know, we started looking at each other, you know, and we're very good at picking up the cues that make something alive versus something that's not alive, i.e. going to eat us. And that even translates, you know, like you say, to things, little things in the real world, because you might not get every little glint, or it also is going to cast a shadow over there, na 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 na. All that stuff just happens in the real world. And you don't have to fight it. But, I'm not against CGI. I don't mean to sound that way, but, you know, I'm also very much for practical when it makes sense.
Right. I think, again, like everything else, you need to understand when to use a tool. These are all tools in a toolbox, and there's a time to use a particular tool and a time to use another one. So, you know,
right.
Yeah, if you're going to try to do something that's really, really complex that simply cannot exist in real life and cannot be made practically, either full size or in scale, CGI, why not? Or subtle CGI.
Just imagine R2-D2, if R2-D2 had been CGI from the beginning.
Right.
He'd never would have been the same.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been, he would have been unreal. The gravitas to which I referred earlier is interesting. When you use a practical model, all of the subtle things that we deal with involving understanding an object in space. And I don't mean interstellar space. I mean physical space.
Real space.
Real space. Meat space. All the subtle things that we haven't quite figured out yet or haven't been able to calculate are given to us for free.
Exactly, yeah.
Whereas in CGI space, you have to remember to add all that in. And right. No one remembers to add it all in. They add 90% of it.
Well, you just don't have time to add it all in. You know?
Well, right, exactly. You know, they add just enough to try to give you a suspension of disbelief. And, right. You know, subject to the technological limitations of the time.
It's still so much just relies on the artists, even today. I mean, even with motion capture, you know, some people think that motion capture is a push-button thing, but there's still a lot of finessing that goes on because, for instance, your actors aren't actually jumping off a huge building and they never reach terminal velocity, you know, so when they hit the ground, it's not the same. You know, and that has to be tweaked by the animator to make it look real, because that person didn't just jump off a balcony. They just jumped off a little thing and landed on a pad.
Right, right. Yeah, there's so much more to merely recording the action. If they recorded the action and just input it, then it would look fake because you didn't get the person to actually do that.
Right, they did it as well as they could given the situation, but, you know, it's never going to be the same thing. And to go back to something earlier and to give some of the artists, you know, their props, when we were talking about, you know, practicals and CGI and whatnot, you know, these people really, it's not push-button animation. And, like, it drives some of them crazy. It drives me crazy when I hear it, when someone says, oh, well, you know, these days you just push a button and you got spaceship. You know, we don't have to go through all the stuff we used to do. It's like, no, that's not true. Someone has to design that ship. They have to model it. They have to build it. They have to shade it. They have to work on the physics of it, how it works. And, you know, artists actually still have to do stuff. So it just drives me crazy when people say that, because there are people, you know, out there working, you know, until
ridiculous hours in order to do this on time and on budget.
Not doing it behind a motion control camera, maybe, but they are still out there busting their asses, so give them a break.
Cronkite, in a television special, commented on the possible lasting impact of Star Wars.
The complicated mixture of sophisticated technology, space-age machinery, and starry-eyed fantasy in today's science fiction films just may serve as inspiration for a coming generation of scientists.
But even the... Exactly. I mean, and I think that happens everywhere. You know, you get the outsiders who don't really know enough or don't understand enough and really think that whatever someone does is, because it's available, because they saw it, you know, it's on the cinema or on television or what have you, that it is somehow very simple and they could do it themselves. You know, that happens a lot with a lot of, you know, modern art, you know, the canvases, the pure white canvases or what have you, of like, oh, well, you know, I could have done that, or, you know, my 2-year-old son could have done that, or my dog could have done that. It's like, yeah, but they didn't.
Exactly. and also nostalgia starts to eat into that too, you know. I've heard some people I respect who were model makers, you know, back in the day, and I've heard them disparage, you know, some CGI stuff and, you know, talk about it being push button this and that. But, you know, that's really mostly it's a nostalgia that our brains.
I think it's also a little bit of jealousy envy.
But,
Because I think that the successful practical folks, you know, what they did, I mean, they did because that's, you know, that's what they learned, but their craft was making models. The medium has changed and the smart ones are, you know, have moved. You know, it's like being a film camera operator versus a video camera operator. You know, it's ostensibly, or rather, there are very similar things. They're different, but you know, the time is such that people are moving away from film mostly and going into video, like a video workflow. There's no reason that they couldn't have gone from a practical workflow to a digital model workflow. Of course, nowadays...
a lot of those people are.
It's sort of interesting. Well, right. But nowadays, what has happened is instead of modeling only on the computer, they'll make a practical, and they'll scan it or they'll recreate it in on the computer. So the practical making is still there.
Yeah, I mean you go to any effect shop, you're going to see maquettes of things. You know, and someone had to make that. You know, it didn't just spit out of a computer. At least not yet.
I mean, very often they start as you know, pencil sketches that turn into maybe ink sketches, which turns into a clay maquette, which gets 3D scanned or recreated entirely digitally from scratch.
Or there might be a maquette for the modelers to work on, and then there's another one for the people who are doing the surfaces and shading, because, all right, here's what it looks like and here's what its scales look like, and they're this kind of color and they look like this and they have this kind of texture, and here it is in front of you, so you can, while you're painting, you can look at that. You know, it may be a physical thing, or it might be a painting, or it might just be, you know, done in Photoshop, but someone's making that stuff. And I'll tell you, I don't want to rag on these guys, but if you get the Earth versus Flying Saucers, there's a special edition with commentary from some of the people. They do a little bit of that, you know, it was always better then. But some of that still, you find that in the audience as well. Like, you know, Ray Harryhausen, it was so much better when it was like that. It's like, no, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. It was crap. It was like six frames a second.
That's nostalgia, because you loved that when you were a kid. But saying that it's better is disingenuous.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you take a look at the original Tontons. I mean, they were stop motion animation. But
go motion.
In my brain, I remember them being really fantastic.
Well, at the time, you know, we had seen, like, we had seen Harryhausen, and we'd seen, you know, the state of the art in stop motion. But the go motion process was created for that, and that's, you know, that was. It wasn't revolutionary, but it was highly evolutionary. And, you know, so it, to us at the time, it looked great.
It was certainly groundbreaking. And that's the big thing, is that, you know, yes, a lot of people are ragging on Lucas now because, okay, the prequel trilogy was pretty awful, or at least from you know, the adult
very
perspective. very, very awful. The re-releases of the original trilogy, you know, we think they're horrible because we've got this impression in our minds of what was, and we loved that. And that is the thing that we grabbed onto. And now these new re-releases, both the special edition in the 90s, as well as the newly re-released Blu-rays, they're different, and they're not what we remember. They are other. And the worst part about it is it's a bit like a kerf. This is my next, what was it? No, it wasn't This Is My Next. Well, it's the Engadget folk. They have an acronym called KIRF. It's Keeping It Real Fake. So it's usually like the Chinese ripoffs of the iPhone, that, you know, it's the same exact housing and everything like that. You know, and a lot of the screens are very similar, but underneath it's running Android, but like a really early edition of Android that's been ripped off from something, you know. You know, in my mind, they are ripoff versions of what I remember.
Well, and they're made to be more like what we got with the final three movies. You know, they, instead of, you know, they were made to be more similar to that in ways, you know, and it just doesn't work.
Well, it doesn't work for us.
It doesn't work for us, but I maintain that it doesn't work at all, because the bulk of those movies don't fit within that. I've used the word aesthetic a lot in this podcast, but you know, those three movies are very visually different. And to try to kind of shoehorn things back in, it just doesn't work, in my opinion. I don't know.
I agree. But I also think, you know, and again, because I agree because I saw the originals and, you know, the originals are a part of me. But I also think that the kids who saw episode 1, episode 2, episode 3 prior to seeing episodes 4, 5, and 6, I don't think they see a difference.
Right. Well, they don't see what we see, for one thing. But right. But just,
and so I think for them it works as well.
I mean, I can still watch the first three because even in the worst, you know, I could still watch them on VHS. Partly because of the nostalgic memory, but also because, you know, the story still works. I'm still at the end, you know, at the end of Empire. I'm still like, you know, so you know.
Sure, I get that, and you know, Empire is easily the best of,
right.
Of
I mean, them. But
I mean, yeah. Full stop. There is no debate on this. Other people may think they
are wrong.
Have you know the better answer. They're wrong. I mean, everything about it is fantastic, and usually middles are not very good. They when you know you're going to have at least one sequel to that. The middle is usually the boring part where you just kind of get over the hump to the ending.
You haven't quite figured out how to get back what you got in the first one. And, you know, you can't.
Right.
You've got to rebottle the lightning.
This is. And they did it. They did it in Empire Strikes Back in a very big way. I mean, you had the Cloud City. I mean, the whole concept of Bespin was fantastic. The pod cars that they had, those twin.
I'm driving.
Yeah, you know, they didn't make sense, but you didn't question
cool,
it when you were watching it. You were just like, that is the coolest
toy.
Freaking thing I've ever seen in my entire life. Yeah. And I know plenty of people who had the toys, you know, and you know, that's where we were introduced to Boba Fett. You know, character that everyone really, really loves. I was never too into him.
Yeah.
You know, and we see Leia in something other than Sticky Bonds. So that was kind of cool. And, you know, Billy Dee Williams.
Rocking it.
I mean, come on.
And now he's I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. And he played such an amazing character as well. You know, he was clearly the thug who tried to straighten up. You know, he's Biggie Smalls. He's 50 Cent.
You're just saying that because he's,
you know,
black,
all
aren't
these.
I know.
No, I'm not. Well, I mean, the same thing.
Well,
with
yeah,
Han,
so,
right?
Han,
you know, he was the smuggler.
If we're talking about, we have to call him Han then, like Billy Dee did. Han.
There we go. Yes,
but yeah, I mean, he Han. Was supposed to be this bad guy, you know. It's like, no. His friend is the real badass.
What? Han Solo ain't never had no sex with Princess Leia in the Star Wars.
Yeah, right. You know, and you had here he was a smuggler. He probably killed a lot of people in his day,
right.
You know, ruthlessly. You know, and you saw that in A New Hope. You know, here he is. He's clearly in trouble with this entity, which was formerly humanoid, Jabba the Hutt, and they turned him into a giant slug creature somewhere down the line. And he one of Jabba's minions comes over, Greedo, to you know, to try to get Han to pay up. And you know what winds up happening? Han shoots Greedo. In cold blood.
For all you kids who are saying, no, that didn't happen. That's what happened.
Oh, yes, it did. That's what actually happened.
But
yeah, no, and that was the big thing. So very early on in the film, you see two big, several acts of violence. You see Obi-Wan Kenobi slice off a guy's hand, and you see Han Solo shoot Greedo, you know, in the face, basically.
You know, and he was basically trying to keep himself alive. I mean...
Well, he was trying to keep himself alive, but also it wasn't...
Oh, I'm not saying it was altruistic. I'm just saying this guy is a smuggler and he's going to get killed. So he basically, you know...
So, it's kill or be
killed. And that's,
killed.
You know, that's also real. But then we got, you know, what we got, walkie-talkies for guns. Oh, sorry, that was a different movie. That was the violence.
No, sorry, different film, yeah.
And then back to Lando, I mean, you know... To their credit, and I don't know if it's Billy Dee that gets credit for this or the writing and the way they did the character. To their credit, this guy is dangerous and unpredictable, but he doesn't come across as scary. So, like, kids aren't scared of him. But as if you're above a certain age, you realize this guy cannot be trusted. I mean, later, you know, he saves the day and everybody's happy, but... When you meet him and you find you see what he does, you know, this guy is dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, he speaks out of both sides of his face. You know, he's very much buddy-buddy with his old friends, and that's all really great. But he knows damn well that he's trying to, you know, get this thing out with Darth Vader. He's got no problem selling his best friend down the river.
And like you say, you know, it kind of informs who Han Solo is. It's like, this might be his best friend, but these guys are mercenaries and, you know, they're smugglers. And, you know, so your best friend, you know, isn't like you're my best friend. Your best friend is another smuggler who will kill or be killed.
It's check your neck. That's what time it is. You know, thieves are not nice people.
Right. And plus, by this point, though, we've had the redemption of Han Solo. So now he's not the guy he was at the start of, you know, A New Hope. So then, you know, we get...
So it makes him being sold down the river that much more dramatic.
Yeah, so now you're like, but he's changed.
Yeah, and that was the big thing. Oh, okay. So we now feel for this formerly cold-blooded killer, because if you take a look at the scene at the bar, Greedo probably wouldn't have shot Han right then and there, because ultimately Greedo wouldn't have gotten the money back, and that's what he came for. He didn't care about Han being alive or dead, but if Han was dead, then he couldn't get the money. And so Han did the only thing that he could have done, which was to shoot Greedo.
Yeah, I have to get out of here. And the only way I'm going to get out of here is if I kill this guy.
And there you go. And apparently, in that particular bar, they don't mind people being ridiculously gruesomely murdered. Because they, you know, the band starts playing, you know,
what's
again.
What's funny is, and I don't remember exactly where I got all this. You know, I think it may have been from some of the books, which aren't canon and all that. But the way it's supposed to be, you know, why are all those stormtroopers there? Well, you know, the bar is supposed to be under the Imperials are watching and everything. So all this stuff that's happening in the bar is part of what the Imperials are there to stop.
That is fantastic, terrific work. So no weaknesses at all, huh?
No.
You hesitated there. Is it something I should know?
No, it's virtually indestructible, like 99.99%.
Yeah, I know, and that's the thing that I really had a hard time with, reconciling the original trilogy versus the modern prequel trilogy, which was, the prequel trilogy happened not particularly a long time prior to... the original trilogy, because, you know, here we have Luke and Leia, and they are the son and daughter of Darth Vader and some chick to be named
There's no getting
later.
Around that, because we know basically how old they are.
Right. Well, that was the other thing as well. You know, when I saw it in, you know, the late 70s, I assumed that Luke was probably in his early 20s and such. But as it turns out, if you really pay attention, like I apparently don't, he's right. much younger than that. He's like right. 16,
he's just out
17.
Of schools, but you know, and he wants to go to the academy, yeah. So.
Right, yeah, he's basically the equivalent of about to go to, you know, like college or, you know, not university.
Join the army.
Okay, backing up a little. Right. Yeah, backing up a little. So, you know, college is like the baby version of university. So you'd go from like secondary school to a college and then to university if you felt like doing that. And so, yeah, you'd be around 17 years old, right. give or take, you know, and that's sort of where he came out. And if Luke and Leia are twins, that means that she's roughly the same age as well, which makes her way more badass than anyone ever thought.
Right.
Because here she is, she's like, you know, 16, 17, her planet just exploded. You know, that's pretty intense.
Right.
And, here she is being a major leader of the resistance at, you know, 16.
Not only that, she's already, she already has diplomatic credentials, you know, she's,
yeah, how do you do that? I mean, that's
well,
that's crazy.
I don't know if this is a credit, but in a way, it's also reflected in Amidala in that she is very young when she's on the throne. Now that
right.
might be, I don't know, that might have something to do just to keep the pedophilia element down because she, you know, when she goes after Jake Lloyd, he's a child.
Yeah, exactly. That's just all very, very deeply, deeply unfortunate. And there we see, again, we see a total, you know, weird time
right.
acceleration thing. Here we have a very young Anakin who is, you know, six.
He's supposed to be 10.
Oh, okay. Still. I mean, he's a very short 10, considering Darth Vader
oh,
is,
you know,
know,
I
7
don't know why
feet
I said
tall
that too,
or so.
Think about it. But yeah.
Mm. Oh, I'm sure it's written down somewhere, and I'm sure, you know, someone.
She's a total pederast. I mean.
Yeah, I mean that's creeptastic. That is statutory in a very big way. You know, here he is, a little tiny kid who's clearly still, you know, hanging on to his mom's apron strings. You know, and then in the following film, he's
right.
basically an adult. So, and then, but Amidala
right.
hasn't really aged at all. She started, let's say for sake of argument, 16, 17, and then Anakin grew up in about, you know, Anakin...
is at least 18,
you know, got about
yeah.
8 years on him. Yeah, got at least eight, you know, at least 8 years, like assuming that he started out as 10, got 8 years on him, and Amidala aged, what,
right.
a year or two? You know, so that's a little bit weird. You know, there was a way to do that better, and they didn't do it.
Yeah, and well, and another thing is too. I mean, she supposedly is 14 in the first movie, and I don't see that.
No, not at all. Not
yeah.
actually possible.
I mean, again, that's
but,
probably just a well. She's, you know, she's only 14, and yada yada.
Well, it's like every anime ever, right? They're all drawn as if they're in their 20s and 30s, but apparently they're all 15. Yeah, I'm like, what? So, yeah, I mean, I was starting to talk about Lucas's, you know, everyone being down on him because the, you know, the prequel trilogy wasn't all that great, but the amount of technology that he invented...
Oh.
Or helped invent, you know, is tremendous. I mean, since the dawn of THX-1138, into Star Wars, into all of that stuff, creating, you know, Lucasfilm, creating
right.
Skywalker
again,
sound.
Right, and again, it's that convergence. I'm not trying to steal the thunder here of what we're going to talk about, but that, and we can expound on this, but... just like throwing it all together, it's like THX, edit droid, the sound droid, the computer control, motion control camera, go motion. What am I missing? Well, THX and the tap system.
Yeah, I was going to say, and not to mention, you know, you could even say that Photoshop is indirectly
Pixar, RenderMan,
and yeah, that,
of course,
yeah.
That was a little bit later, but still, I mean, it came out.
Yeah,
of all
it's
that.
Later, but it's right. All part of that. Yeah, I mean, it's really amazing. You know, everyone's using. Lucas's technology. I mean, he didn't technically invent the first nonlinear video editor.
He invented the first one that worked. It was,
yeah. You know, well, I think it was right. The first digital one. The other ones used, what was it? We talked about this before. I believe it was a Maxell creation.
And, oh, they used the giant real stuff, you mean?
Yeah, well, it was computer controlled, and it would it actually had small chunks. I believe it was all stored in analog, right. Much like a laser disc would store an analog image. It would store very small chunks of video at once, and you could create an edit decision right. list based upon that, and then that EDL would then be printed out to hand to the person who would do the actual editing, the physical slicing and dicing of the tape, which was just completely amazing. But Lucas created the first real computer-based one, you know, which allowed, you know, editing that was so much easier once you really sort of understood how to use it, you know. But the idea is that it was very similar to using the old Moviolos and all that in order to do the slicing and the dicing. It's just that it used computer
right. And it was an insane piece of hacking in a way. I mean, but done in a really elegant way. I mean, I don't know if people know this. I mean, it was all done with like laser discs. And you think about it, you know, think about a DVD. Imagine, you know, skipping around, and then of course laser discs were even slower. But you know, it was an amazing thing to do and to push it. And say, we're going to do this. It's going to be hard, and some of it's not going to work great, but we're going to do this. You know, I mean, that's what really drives innovation. I mean, and all props to those guys, you know, and Lucas for building that, because, you know, they didn't have to do it, and they didn't have to spend that money, but by God, they did it.
But they did it. And in order to create the film that matched his vision, or at least matched as closely as it could be, it had to be done.
I mean, and that's the same thing with THX. It wasn't because, oh, we're going to make this and make $1 billion. It was, I want the sound to be very good for my, you know, to do what I want it to do. And so they, you know, they designed this sound spec, and then they designed ways of, you know, of doing that and so forth. I mean, it wasn't, you know, again, he didn't have to do it, but he wanted it. Like all the best things are because you want it, that are built are basically because you want it for yourself.
Well, it's a mark of, right, exactly. And also with a THX certification, it's a mark of a certain level right. of quality. You know that if this is THX certified, you know it meets certain criteria, and you know what you're going to get. It'll at least be right. X good. Right. You know, it may exceed that, and that's lovely. But you know you're not going to get crap sound, assuming that
right.
it's maintained. Obviously, you know, you can buy the stuff that's all in spec, and you can hook it up by, you know, a certified installer and do all that sort of stuff. But if you don't maintain it, you know, it's not going right. to sound as good. It's not going to look as good. You know, that's why the THX folks, you know, have that bumper reel that says, you know, if you experience a problem, yeah. call this number.
I mean, when have you ever seen that in a theater before? You know, if you didn't enjoy yeah. this thing, we're very sorry. Please let us know. I mean, you know, that was unheard of.
And they would actually send people out and say, like, hey, we got a complaint. You know, this needs to be fixed. And they'll send someone out because they cared. They wanted to make sure that the way it looked on the editing station and the way it sounded in, you know, the sound editing room, that final product matched what they saw, you know, in their studios. And that is so important. Let's see, we talked about tech, we talked about motion control rigs, and of course the lovely stepper motor. Well, I mean, that's basically what makes it all happen, right? I mean, the neat part about a stepper motor is that, you know, you have very, very accurate control with what you've got. And exactly, and repeatability. And without that, you've got nothing. I mean, so a motion control rig is ostensibly a camera hooked up to a stepper motor controlled by a computer. Right. It sounds so simple because
it is. And, you know, actually, it's really, at the time, it was more about, well, the computer to control it, you know, but the motors and all that was easy enough. And, you know, I mean, they had to hack together their own, you know, interfaces for, you know, for the motors themselves. I believe that was the case. I don't think they used out of the box. And the word is not.
Yeah, I think they did bodge something together. I think you're right on that. Because otherwise someone would have done it just out of the box. Like,
well, I mean, as far as, you know, because you have to have an encoder to see how far the thing has moved. But, you know, they were doing certain, they needed to be able to change their precision and to change their you know, the number of steps, which is part, you know, stepper motor. You can actually, if a stepper motor has 200 steps, you can actually do more than 200 steps, but that's just how many internally steps, you know, so you have to, you know, change that for the environment you're in.
So the other topic is the special editions, aka the editions that ruined our childhood. And they're bad not just because they altered history, you know. Lucas made the argument that, you know, it's he would have done this if the technology allowed it. I think that's a little revisionist history, but, you know, it is what it is. On some level, it's his baby, but on the other level, it is certainly a part of the collective consciousness of all of Generation X and you know, the surrounding years.
I mean, there's the Kevin Smith argument, like, well, how does it hurt you? You know, what does it do? It doesn't change the world in any way. You don't have to watch it. But it does when the problem is that we can't get at the thing because he won't release the thing, right?
Right. And when he did, it was the shittiest version, you know, that they could, you know, slap on a disc. You know, so the DVDs were released, the DVDs of the special edition were released to the public a while back, and then they re-released the DVDs with the original un-special edition, basically the original version, or what they call the gout version, which is the original uncut the original unspecialized trilogy. The problem though is that they did nothing. They didn't fix the color timing. They didn't do any denoising. They didn't do anything. They didn't do any restoration whatsoever. And so the product that the fans really wanted, you know, was not what they received. And I think that hit a lot of people harder than not.
You know, it's funny, just imagine how many years of consternation and fighting with Lucas, or yelling, not fighting with, yelling at Lucas over this. It could have been, you know, negated just by one time back then releasing the unspecialized versions in a nice print and data and moving on with life. It would be such a different Star Wars world.
Yeah, it'd be, you know, we would have a a proper digital copy of what we remembered as a kid, and that was it. You know, that's fine. You know, it doesn't need to be Blu-rayed out. I mean, it would be lovely if it were, but it wouldn't. We wouldn't need it. You know, and I agree. I think a lot of, you know, pulled hair and a lot of agita and a lot of waste, to be perfectly frank, wasted time, you know, would have
been ended. But, you know, I've told you my conspiracy theory that was done purposefully because he had made this comment about, well, we'll see which sells better, you know, and that he thought that his new vision with all the changes would be superior and that people would recognize that. And of course, the conspiracy theory being that, so they released the crap ass, you know.
He fixed
the game.
He fixed the game, right? And that sucks. And you know, it's not just that the special editions have additional CGI in them, although obviously they do. And the CGI, while you know, very, very au courant for the time. You know, it was the best technology.
Right, and we saw you in Mos Eisley, Stu.
At the time.
You inserted yourself. We saw it.
We saw it. We cannot unsee it. You know, it doesn't cut mustard.
Right.
You know, it just isn't as good. As a practical film, you know, as a practical model, or even if the older effects weren't as good, they at least had their place in the context of the film that was created in the 1970s, and that's kind of okay, you know. But also, the person who did the color grading on it, I think did a fairly well. I don't want to say they did a bad job.
But you don't want to say they did a good job.
Because that's wrong. Well, right. I mean, what I think happened was in the 1970s, I hope I'm not coming down with a cold. That would be really horrible. In the 1970s and up until, I don't know, maybe about 20 years ago, there was an aesthetic to film you know, the colors were more natural because grading a film wasn't easily done. You know, you'd have to do that optically
or chemically,
that's
which is
really difficult
even
to do. Right, and that's just, you know, almost impossible to do with any sort of consistency. And so now, with the advent of digitization, you pretty much can shift anything any way you want. And so for the last, you know, 20-odd years or so, we've almost created a formula where you have... You're trying to... obviously, in color grading, you're trying to invoke a mood. Obviously, that occurs... You know, not only with the color timing, but also with music and with the actual editing and the blocking and all that sort of stuff. But you're trying to create a mood, but you're also trying to introduce color contrast. And because people, regardless of their race, are all ostensibly the same color, if you take a look at them on a scope. You know, they're all on that nice little diagonal line, that, 135-degree line. Some people say people are porange, right. That purple-orange line. I love that. And because people are porange, the opposite color to that is, you know, sort of a cyan. And so what winds up happening is you wind up pushing people into the orange, and you wind up pushing your background into the cyan blue, and therefore you have much more color contrast. Therefore, the people in the scene pop out more. And of course, people want to see people, you know, and that's what has happened. If you take a look at, Transformers is ridiculous for this, by the way. You know, most modern films are pretty awful about it, because they're just pushed so much that, you know, people know, or at least they think they know, what color people are. And this goes beyond into like Oompa Loompa territory, and it's right. pretty depressing. But I think that's what happened. You know, they went for a more modern aesthetic where we've got a much stronger contrast. You know, it's that if you take a look at the curve, you've got that really high end, and then you've got that very precipitous slope, you know, for the mid-range, and then the blacks get crushed.
And this is kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about him trying to push the older films to be more towards his new vision versus vice versa, which would, you know, to me would make more sense. But and also it this is where it comes in, sort of people saying, you know, things like revisionism, you know, a revision of history, because like you said, there was a look, there was an aesthetic for films of the time. But if you go in and try to take that away, it's like saying, oh well, we're going to retake Barbarella and we're going to put a Jennifer Aniston haircutter on it, because that's, you know, that's what we're going to, this obviously in the 90s, but but we're going to put Jennifer Aniston's hair on her because that's popular, and we're going to change the music, and, you know, we're going to put some...
Or we're going to get rid of the go-go boots, and we're going to put in, you know, sandals.
Or we're going to put, yeah, we're going to put, we're going to go for a steampunk look. We're going to put some, you know, clips on those boots or whatever. You know, it's like the whole thing takes away from a part of history that doesn't exist for us anymore. And like we said, if that thing existed, there would be a lot less to bitch and moan about.
Sure. But I think also, and this is something that just occurred to me, but it goes along the lines of some of my earlier thinking that we were talking about, which is you can think of the re-releases not as re-releases, but rather a continuation of the prequel trilogy, as if the prequels were in fact
right
the
now
first
and
films.
there is something to be said for that, because they are episode 1, 2, 3, so, you know, in a way there is something to be said for that, but still, like you said, not done very well.
It's soul crushing.
Well, I mean, not yeah. only that, but
it's, I mean, for us it's soul crushing, but again, for the kids who didn't grow up in the 70s and didn't see it originally, you know, all the changes fit in their understanding of what Star Wars is all about. So really what they've done, what Lucas has done, is he has made the original trilogy consistent with the prequel trilogy, because it's for
only
children,
to a degree, because know? There's only so much he can do. I mean, and you know, throwing some dewbacks and some more stormtroopers in Mos Eisley, you know, doesn't bring you up to, you know, episode one. And then just, you know, changing I want to say the LUT, but this is all after the fact. I mean, you know, changing the look of the film. I don't know. I would have been, I'm actually fine with them changing the look of the film and regrading and all that, because it could look somewhat better. And I somehow know that we're going to get to talking about that in a minute, because someone has actually done that.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, because Lucas has gone in this other direction and has decided that, you know, these films are for kids of a particular era. You know, the first films were yeah. for our era. For
not
our
you,
generation.
You dirty adult. Go get a job and shut up.
Yeah, there's exactly. You know, this it's just not for us, and so be it.
Except we're the ones that have the money.
But because he's gone there, yes, exactly. But because he's gone in that direction, it's the rise of 1,000 alternative fan edits. So, and these are cats who've gone out and said, you know, I really love these films. I love these films so much that I am interested in curating these films and turning them into what they believe those right. films should be. So, you know, they do it out of a labor of love. You know, they're not trying to to make money off of it. As a matter of fact, that would be highly illegal. Probably what they were doing in the first place is illegal, but it's done, you know, it's not meant to screw right. George out
because
of
money. Because George obviously has
at all.
No interest in doing what they're doing.
Right. And so so really it's a bunch of things, right? It's a labor of love. It's also a test of your own skill. So if you are interested in becoming an editor or a colorist or anything like that, you're trying to learn Avid, you're trying to learn Final Cut, you're trying to learn, you know, any sort of non-linear video editing, you know, why not cut your teeth on that? You know, because it's something that everyone knows, it's something that that people are familiar with, and if it's something that you right. love, you know, you're going to be more interested in pursuing that than if it were, you know, some random video that you shot of you and your mates right. in your backyard, where you don't necessarily yet understand story or how to cut or what have you. Here you have something that already exists that you theoretically really love, and you want to see what you can do with it.
Right.
Like, I think
and
cool.
with Star Wars, you know, like you say, if it's something you love, then you're going to spend, you know, more time on it. And of course, with Star Wars, this is the sort of love where you, you know, I'm going to lock you in the basement kind of love.
It's well, it's
because
the blood,
we're all
right, exactly. It's the blood, sweat,
over,
and tears.
You know?
Right. It's the blood, sweat, and tears. And the neat part about it is if you do a good job, there are other people out there who are going to really enjoy it. And that's also pretty cool. So, you know, there are hundreds of fan edits. Some of them are the entire film. Some of them are just parts. But one of the first ones that I really got to know very well was the Dr. Gonzo DVD edition, where this was prior to the DVDs coming out. What this fellow did was he took footage from the original Laserdisc, or maybe not the original Laserdisc, but it was the one, because I think there were two issues of the Laserdisc. One was a CAV,
right,
one
right.
was a CLV. And they took, they basically took the Laserdisc, digitized it, and put it on DVD. You know, cleaned it up a little bit, did a little bit of denoising, did a little bit of, you know, color retiming, recolor grading, and then popped it onto DVD, complete with some rudimentary menus and such. And that was the Dr. Gonzo edit. And of course, it didn't have any of the new special effects from the special editions that came out in the 90s. And so that was pretty cool. And I watched that.
I haven't seen that one.
Well, now, you know, there are sort of more updated ones. But that used to be the canonical, like, this is the guy who did it right version, as opposed to the people who, you know, they did it, but maybe they didn't do that great a job, or they didn't actually complete all three of them. This guy did all of them, and he loosed them onto the internet for anyone to grab, if you happen to know the secret location. Which is, you know, one of those, that happens very often, you know, obviously this has to be kept somewhat on the DL, you know, because distribution, doing it for yourself, for your own purpose, circulating it amongst a small group of your own friends, probably not that big a deal. You're certainly not
right.
going to get caught then. Loosing it onto the internet, that's a different story entirely. And if you can do it anonymously, then you're good to go. But if you can't, then there are problems.
It's like...
and then...
Sorry, go ahead.
Which of course brings us to so that's one type of fan edit. The other type is to actually completely recut the film, right? So to make a different story, and that's kind of cool because you know I don't know if you've seen the there are some trailers out there that recut old horror movie trailers to be something entirely
some
different.
Some of them are absolutely brilliant.
So like The Shining is now a rom com. it's so brilliant. You know, you had a different soundtrack and you cut the trailer differently, and then suddenly
The Shining is probably the most well known because it has that Peter Gabriel song that every love movie has in it. You know, I know.
Is it Salisbury Hill?
Yeah.
Or is it... Oh, God. Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's certainly one of my favourite Peter Gabriel songs. My God. We'll track that down as well. And so one fellow, Mark J. Nichols, he created the Phantom Edit. And as a matter of fact, he's been on John Flowers, or I guess Kanan Flowers, That Post Show, which is a really fantastic podcast. I highly suggest checking it out. I think he produces one every other week, or maybe once a month or so. They're a lot of fun. He's a fellow who knows a lot of fun people, and so he's constantly bringing in really quality guests and just allowing them to talk.
Some people might know Mike does the Two Guys Drinking at a Bar. It's a video podcast / show / thing on the internet, which is kind of a short comedy thing.
Neat. And if I recall correctly, doesn't his... No, I'm sorry. That's someone else entirely. he recently, very often, Flowers has more than one guest on the show at once. And so I was at... I recently listened to one of his episodes, and he had someone else on as well. And I just conflated the two of them in my head for a moment. But the Phantom Edit is also really interesting. He re-edits the Phantom Menace and turns it into something that is actually worth watching. He cuts out most of the slapstick bullcrap. he gets rid of a lot of Jar Jar. I don't think he... Does he eliminate Jar Jar entirely?
I don't think he eliminates entirely. I haven't actually watched the whole thing, so I've only seen the bits and pieces.
Yeah, and it's been forever since I've seen it. So,
actually, it was everyone attributed this... They were saying that it was Kevin Smith had done it, and that's why no one knew who had done it, because originally Nichols didn't own up to it right away, I don't think. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that was the whole thing, is that this was anonymous, it was let loose on the internet, it was circulating... I guess around Hollywood.
Right, it was a tighten up edit.
And it was a big mystery. Right, right. And it wound up, they also got rid of all of the, Mike got rid of all of the incredibly boring Senate stuff.
Which was fodder for web comics for like a year.
I mean, it was horrible, horrible filler.
Switched the channel to space C-SPAN for a moment or something.
Yeah. I remember seeing it and just like, I can fall asleep right now. There's no reason for this whatsoever. It doesn't move the plot forward. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with, having a character happen to mention... this thing happened on the Senate floor the other day.
But no, we had to see the whole procedure. A
simple one-liner. Yeah, we had to see the equivalent of, an entire year's worth of...
The Senate recognizes the ambassador from the great star system of Pegasus.
The 12-armed blobule in... Yeah, no, none
oh,
of that.
Who did... Was it Futurama that did the... Oh, they did a thing on it, and I can't remember how it went. Oh. But I guess, several, shows, I think even maybe like Family Guy or so whatever, have since done it. But, it's just so, it's just mind-numbing. So Mike took that out.
Mike made a fairly awful film watchable. And Mike, here's to you. I'm raising my glass. Thank you very much.
And he did it off
of
VHS, right?
I believe so. Yeah, which was crazy. I mean, serious masochism. Yeah. Luckily, we talked about the Dr. Gonzo stuff. We talked about Phantom Edit. Recently, within the last year or so, this Czech fellow that goes by the name Harmy. Maybe that's his actual name, maybe it's not, his nom de internet, he decided that he was going to create a despecialized edition of the original trilogy, where he takes out all of the extraneous CGI sequences, but still cleans everything up. And what he wound up doing was he wound up finding original celluloid, 70mm and 35mm prints, scanning those in and using those as mats, as well as scanning in high-resolution images from various Lucasfilm books as mats, and creating the film not in SD, but in HD, prior to the Blu-rays even coming out, and using various source material to do so. And these edits are fantastic. They're graded very, very well. They're a pleasure to watch.
The grading is actually, after everyone watched it a second time, the grading is actually, I think, the thing I appreciate the most. I mean, I know there's a lot of hard things there were to do, like you said, using these still images to make mats to take things out or to fix things that have changed, like the sand crawler scene where there's a wipe and there's just, you know, he had to basically recreate this thing. But the grading is just phenomenal. It's just done. It's all the things that we were saying bad earlier. Fixed.
Fixed. Right. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I mean, right now, the Harmy Despecialized Edition HD is probably the best... well, I don't know if I can actually say that, because, you know, the Blu-rays are quite good in, you know...
They look very, very nice. I will give them that, you know. That all of the stuff that they said that they didn't have to do, all these things that we wanted them to do, they obviously have, because they had to have used them at some point to make these Blu-rays.
Well, right, exactly. And you know, and they still wind up grading it heavy, you know, very heavy.
I mean, it does look better. So, I mean, still.
It looks better, but again, it's inconsistent.
Watching the scene Luke in his kimono looking, you know, out across the desert on the Harmy edition and watching the Blu-ray are two different things as far as visually.
Yeah, one's actually good.
So.
And that's just it. You know, the Harmy edition, even though it is, and you really wouldn't know this unless you read up on the background. It's scrounged from all sorts of different sources. It's scrounged from the an HD 720. Interpolation of, I believe, the French laserdisc.
Yeah, since they had more scan lines, I guess.
Right, which is bizarre.
And DVD up-res, which look so much better than I ever could imagine that they would. So it's whoever up-res was using some quality gear or something, I don't know, or spent a lot of time,
yeah, exactly. And Harmy did everything in After Effects. You know, he just piped it all into After Effects and did each film, and it took him, you know, several months. I think, I forget exactly how long it took him to do each film, but it was a surprise. It was a long time, but it was a surprisingly short period of time. He did them very quickly because, you know, he would just lock himself in his editing room and work for, you know, hours and hours and hours at a time. So, again, hats off to Harmy and his Despecialized Edition. I highly suggest trying to track them down. If you happen to know someone who knows someone, they may be able to supply you with a URL.
Or go
to their house and make a thing of it, you know. Bring some beer, bring some popcorn, and, you know, kick
I
back
like
on the
wheat
big screen.
Beers,
and really
I
enjoy
like
it.
Hefeweizens, and I like, oh, sorry.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of all of these things, so let's get on that. So I think that's it. We've run a little bit long, but I think we're okay. Yeah. We've got some editing to do.
What's all this wee stuff?
Yeah, that's true. And I'm going on holiday.
Remember to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Music for Ruining It for Everyone provided by Kevin MacLeod.
There we go.
I love Ben Durbin. Don't you love Ben Durbin?
I love Ben Durbin. Ben.
You're so... how we got on this subject, we won't cover, but it'll be uncomfortable, I'm sure. But we love you, Ben.
Oh, that's creepy.